Hey, thanks for checking out Dynasty Mode. Just Mike here for this one. This is a repeat of something that I did during the middle of last season. I had a conversation with a friend of the pod, Daniel Adler. If you're not familiar with him, which I don't know why you would be necessarily, he is the former director of football research for the Jacksonville Jaguars, and he's the current assistant general manager of the Minnesota Twins. He was in the Dynasty League that this podcast often references until he became too busy playing fantasy baseball for a living at the highest level. He did quite well in the Dynasty League, so I decided to pick his brain a little bit about what translates from his real job to fantasy. Given it being draft season, it seemed pretty relevant to put this up again. If you enjoy it, please like and subscribe and reach out to us at Dynasty Mode Pod on social media or dynastymodepod@gmail.com, and I'll do my best to get Daniel to have another conversation with me. So I hope you enjoy this and it helps you win your drafts. All right, we have Daniel Adler here. He is the current assistant general manager to the Minnesota Twins, but more for this, you were the former director of football research for the Jaguars, correct?
Correct.
You held a position with the Browns, right?
I interned for the Browns for a couple summers.
And then you drove a van for the Patriots.
Drove a van for the Patriots, an illustrious career.
Yeah. Doug handles most of our Patriots stuff, so I won't ask you too much about the van. So the first question, is, how are you at fantasy sports?
Not particularly good. We've played in the league, together for a couple years, although that league got too intense for me and I had to let it go. I think the moment I knew that league was too intense was when we had the draft. It was a dynasty league, and we had the draft over the summer. And after about the first five picks, I hadn't even heard of guys, and I was texting you to just tell me who to draft. I'd say I am maybe above average, kind of Lake Wobegon effect type situation.
Yeah, I mean, you picked the baseball player with your first round pick. You picked Kyler Murray.
Hey, he had a pretty solid year.
No. It was a very good pick. Do you think your career is potentially why you don't think you're good at it? Because you're looking at it from a different, entirely different way?
I think in baseball, we have a lot of tools for projection that go much deeper than anything I have access to in football these days. And so and I also know those projections still miss a lot. So that might add a little to it that I understand how hard it is to really predict what's going to happen.
Gotcha. So the whole reason I came up with the idea to talk to you was I had the first rep pick in the draft in the league that you left. And I was heavily considering Jonathan Taylor, who was generally considered the number two guy on the board. And I, was kind of telling myself, oh, I'm so smart. I'm doing the right thing here. And so I reached out to you and I said, when you think one way and 9 out of 10 go the other way, what do you do? And you, what did you say to me?
I'm trying to remember if I'm answering this fresh, because I don't remember my exact response. I probably said, usually go with the wisdom of the crowds.
Right. Or I mean, that is what you told me. That is what you told me. Good. That's what I ended up doing. So, but I thought that was interesting that even when you are very smart in a certain thing, if you don't at least think that you're smarter than everybody in the room.
Usually I would say I never think I'm smarter than everybody in the room. If I have a different view, the move is probably find somebody who's willing to pay for that pick and then pick Taylor later. Now it's hard in that case. If you like the consensus number two person, you might not have the opportunity to move down and still get him. But we think about that. I mean, with our team, when there's a projection that we think is much better than other teams are going to feel, it doesn't mean we're going to go offer them 100% of that value. You want to bake in some room to be wrong.
Right. Okay. So this is the question. I mean, I guess
This is more football related. I don't know how much it necessarily depends on baseball, especially because there's no salary cap. Would you rather start a team with the best player or the best deal?
In football, I would say best. You're talking about a real football team or a fantasy?
If you're building a fantasy football team and you have an auction draft, I think it would be kind of similar. You know, if you could get Christian McCaffrey at his going rate, or, you know, somebody not Christian McCaffrey, but at a very good price for them, you know, what are you picking?
So fantasy football, I probably would say best deal. Real football, I would say best player. And that's largely just because I think quarterbacks are still undervalued in terms of how impactful they are. That the best quarterback probably should be paid much more than they are, given how important they are.
All right. So when you're looking at data, do you prefer to find data that proves your point or disproves your point? Or do you just you just don't care either way?
I mean, I think it's only human to want to be right and want to find reasons to confirm whatever your beliefs are. I try to not let that sort of ego-driven attitude shape things. I'd be lying if I said it's more fun to be right. But you certainly learn a lot more when you're wrong. And I've tried at different points. Sometimes I'm more deliberate about it than others, to like really almost try to reprogram my brain to want to be wrong and like try to find reasons and whatever like dopamine hit you get from being right, to try to reverse your thinking so you have that when you're wrong. I haven't fully successfully done that, but I try, and I'd like to think that I'm a little faster to jump over to the other side when I get new data than others.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. If you're looking at a player, what do you value more, their floor or their ceiling?
Sort of just depends on where you're picking that player. And like for, you know, a late pick, and this is now fantasy football. For a late pick, I would say it would really just all be about the ceiling, because who cares what the floor is? If the guy, you know, is on the edge of being drafted, you can always go find a replacement player. For the higher end players, you know, this the floor probably matters more. For your first round pick, having a guy with a decent floor is feels to me more important. I haven't studied it exactly, but certainly late, I don't really care about the floor at all, because you can just drop the guy and it
doesn't
matter.
Yeah, because the floor is zero essentially there.
Yeah.
So Daryl Morey said something that I thought was super interesting on Bill Simmons' podcast, and I wanted to ask your opinion on it. He said that a pick is more valuable than a player. When he traded Kyle Lowry, that the first round pick he was able to get was worth more than Kyle Lowry, even though Kyle Lowry was a good player. Do you agree, disagree, somewhere in the middle, that a pick is more valuable because you can kind of shape it to be what you want rather than the pre-established player?
It's not going to be true 100% of the time either way. You know, there are players who are better than pretty much any pick. There are picks that are better than any player. I don't know if his philosophy was that they have a system that they want to teach people or something like that. I think one thing I observed when I was working in the NFL is that I think people get really excited about individual players. Like when they're moving up in the draft, you will move up, you'll give up a fourth round pick to move up five slots, you know, from the 37th pick to the 32nd. Somebody will give up a lot of value. And when it's just this abstract thing of a fourth round pick, people are willing to do it. Whereas one of the things I pushed for when I was in Jacksonville was like thinking about, okay, who is that fourth round pick going to turn into? You know, fast forward a little bit. Let's look at our board. Let's see how historically things have stacked up. Okay, that fourth round pick, that's going to probably be the 80th guy on your board or something much higher than the absolute pick number. And then suddenly it becomes much more painful to give up that guy to move up five spots. So I don't, that's not 100% answering like which one's more valuable, but I do think when it's an abstract thing that sometimes teams will under, at least in the NFL draft, you see that a lot, that I think on the day of the draft, once teams have a player in mind that they're targeting to move up, they're giving up this abstract later pick. I think teams undervalue those later picks.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that does make sense that all of us, I mean, if you're doing in this format where you have a rookie draft, that if you're really targeting a guy that you kind of do give up what could be, you know, a still pretty decent player in the third round to move up a couple spots because you get attached to him. I was thinking about this when I wrote this. There's no draft pick trading in baseball, correct?
Very limited. We are allowed to trade just the competitive balance picks. So literally there's about about 14 or so teams that receive those, something in there. So very few of the picks can be traded.
Gotcha.
It doesn't work like football where you're like trading them day of. The interesting thing in the baseball draft is that your each pick is associated with a dollar amount that you can give to signing bonus. And sometimes what teams will do is shave money on an earlier pick and then spend extra money later. And so that is like sort of the equivalent of trading down a little bit, that you have $1 million slot, you only give it 500,000 to that guy, and then you spend that extra 500 later. That is a little bit like trading down.
All right. In a snake format, would you rather take a lesser player in a tier of guys to have your pick come back, or do you want the best guy? So say like, you know, 1 through 5 picks, you know, 4 isn't that much worse than 1. Are you okay with taking 4 so that you have, you know, pick number 18 instead of 24 or what, you know, what have you?
If you truly feel that it's pretty flat in that 1 through 5 range, what you described, I think makes a lot of sense. I think historically, at least in real drafts that I've studied, the gap between 1 and 2 is larger than the gap between 2 and 3, 3 and 4. So things tend to get flatter as the draft goes along. So I would say if that is the actual talent distribution, you're probably better off just having the earlier pick and not, you know, not picking 2 later in the first round in order to pick 2 earlier in the second. But what you described, if it really is kind of a, you know, a toss up between a handful of guys, sure. That's kind of my general philosophy in most player acquisitions, which is if there's a group that is pretty similar, let somebody else basically pay extra to make that decision and just take whoever is left.
Gotcha. All right. Couple more. I'm basically thinking about two guys who I know that you're so deeply involved in baseball at this point, you might not even know. But there was Devontae Parker last year who, I mean, I'm sure he came into the league while you were still doing football, finally lived up to expectations after, you know, the last 8 games of the season. And it seems as though all of his stink is just washed off him this year. People are super high on Devontae Parker, top, you know, 10, 15 wide receiver. And then there's Breshad Perriman, who also bombed harder, completely bombed out of the league, came back, kind of did the same thing with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and people are still super questioning it. And I'm just wondering why some guys are able to just wash this stink off so easily and others can't? Is it just like some tape scouting thing that we can't, you know, my eyes and the normal fan can't see? Or is it just groupthink, you know, the fantasy experts are telling you Devontae Parker's great and Rashad Perriman's a question mark? Or is that just something you don't even understand why that happens?
It's a really, really good question. I've got their book guys, Pro Football Reference pages up here. And I didn't realize, I think they may have been, were they drafted in the same year? They were both first round picks in 15.
Yeah, I mean, they're very parallel careers. I mean, Perriman bottomed out harder. I think
he was actually a total. I remember when he was on the Browns in 18, being like, "Oh my gosh, I've heard of this guy." And I think they picked him up maybe mid-season
that year. Yeah, I mean, I think he was even like on the streets at one point. So,
yeah, it's an interesting question, and I don't know if some of that is driven by feeling like the supporting cast, but it is weird to me. I don't know, but not knowing a ton about either player. Neither were in the league when I was working for the Jags. So I don't have a ton of insight into either player, but I think the concept of, I've always been interested in, let's say there's two guys who have very, very similar seasons. One was a first round pick. One was a fifth round pick. And two guys with extremely similar careers, 3 years in, one was a first round pick, one was a fifth round pick. Is there any reason to treat the first rounder differently? Like, does that guy have something extra in terms of physical abilities that he might be better than the fifth rounder? Or you could craft the opposite story, which is the fifth rounder had to prove himself. He wasn't given anything. If he's been able to produce just as much as the first rounder, maybe the arrow signs pointing up higher for him. There's probably not a like one size fits all answer to that. It's a little bit of a, I guess, kind of Bayesian updating. Like, as you get new information, how do you decide how to value a guy? But it is a weird thing to me that Perriman, and maybe it's just because Perriman was like literally out of the league, and whereas Devontae Parker's always stayed around, even though he's been kind of lackluster. But and I'm looking at the numbers here. I mean, I think Perriman had, 645 yards, and Parker had 1,200 yards last year.
Yeah, I mean, so there is a difference in it, but it just seems weird that, like, Parker just completely rid himself. You know, it's like, he was just injury, you know, prone. Oh, the system wasn't right. It's like, there's been plenty of guys who have been injury prone and in the wrong system and still, you know, did more with the pedigree than he did.
Yeah, it's interesting when there's guys who people expect to be really good and they finally put it together once and then everybody says, okay, he's got it now. This is happening, versus the guy who people are making excuses and say, okay, he's finally, he's hit, he's going to be good, versus guys on the other side where you're almost looking for excuses to say, this is all a mirage. But it is weird because they both have at least similar draft pedigree.
Yeah. So it's funny because I'm going to mention a Jaguars player, but you know, that just sort of is happenstance. We talked about it on the podcast we recorded last night. There'll be a one in between that and this, but I was saying, do you buy a player like DJ Chark kind of low now because presumably the Jaguars are going to get a better quarterback? And is that something that, like, teams are kind of plotting out in advance? Like, we expected, you know, Chark's going to be better, so we should try to extend him now because presumably we're going to bring in a high draft capital quarterback who's going to improve him.
It's an interesting philosophy. I won't comment on Chark in particular, but I do think if you're a team just in this kind of general idea where if you feel like a guy's stats and some of the things that get him paid have been held down by maybe a lackluster supporting cast, I think that theory makes a lot of sense to me. I probably would want to you know, buy into him when, if you feel like those stats are what he's getting paid for. In like in baseball, for example, you know, there probably was a time where pitcher wins were very heavily valued. And if you were a bad team and your pitcher had a, you know, 8-12 record, but he was really good, you probably could get a discount on him. That doesn't really happen anymore because teams just don't look at that. And I would imagine, you know, in football, again, it's hard to judge a wide receiver without the quarterback, but I do think that's probably baked into his, you know, asking price for a contract, at least somewhat. But I think you're right. If he's probably, his stats are in that situation you described, the player stats might be artificially depressed.
So, I mean, so you would say safe to say that like some of these really bad teams, if they have a good wide receiver and they could get a better quarterback, that this might be the time to try to buy them.
Potentially. I think the one thing that I think about a lot, and this is more of a theory that I shouldn't say theory. This is just an observation I had as a kid watching some really terrible Cavs teams in the 90s and early 2000s before LeBron. And I remember watching Lamond Murray and Ricky Davis, and like those guys would score about 20 points a night. And the reality is even a really crappy NBA team is going to put up, you know, at the time, I don't know what the league average was scoring.
Somebody's going to score the points.
Yeah, somebody's going to score the points. So even on a really bad team, somebody's going to have, you know, 20-ish a game if you have your points concentrated that way. So it doesn't necessarily mean that guy is actually any good at all. And so that's the one risk, is if your team is not good, somebody is still going – like you're still going to have a running back. And you could feed him the ball a bunch, and that guy could run for, you know, 1,200 yards in a season. It doesn't necessarily mean he's all that good. So that's the counter to it. If you're really just paying for the stats.
All right. Well, that's actually kind of a good lead in for my last question for you, which was, actually no, I have two. But would you prefer a guy who is clear path for a lot of volume, I should say, or a guy who probably has more talent but has players in front of him?
Oof. Probably, again, my gut reaction to this is you're probably better off just getting the guy who's going to have a lot of volume, especially at the running back position. It just feels like it's just so much about your opportunities. So that's probably where my gut would lead me. Obviously there are situations where really talented players have been blocked and an injury or poor performance in front of them opens up an opportunity. It works out well, but it just seems like you look at the way running backs are valued. It's not even necessarily like the great running backs who are considered, really valuable fantasy pieces. A lot of it's just much more about like, is this guy going to be, you know, is he going to get almost every carry? Is the team going to run the ball a decent amount? Is he going to get fed the ball near the goal line? Like that's so much, probably more important than talent. At least, you know, obviously to be the top performer, you have to have ridiculous talent, but to be a moderate performer, it's much more about opportunity.
Right. So you're saying like, you know, you're pick 100 out of, you know, so you're deep in the draft, you're going volume guy over, you know, talent guy who might have three guys better, you know, he's the wide receiver 4 and you could get the wide receiver 2. You're picking the wide receiver 2 because he's just going to get more balls.
Probably. I guess if it's a dynasty league, that obviously changes the thought process a lot there. You'd probably bet on the long-term talent more. This year might be an interesting one, and it remains to be seen, but the COVID situation may make the opportunities for guys further down the depth chart a lot more frequent. So that there's probably just an extra dash of injury randomness this year that maybe adds to those, those guys who are not lining up for a lot of volume right now, that could make them more appealing. But in general, it does seem like just having a guy, I feel like I've had just anecdotally a number of times where there's a player I have who has like great rate stats. He's killing it every time. And they just, there's some old guy in front of him who's the established veteran, and the young guy doesn't get the ball.
Right. All right. Last question. Here's your opportunity to, you know, really pump yourself up. Is there any move, whether it was like that guy, we got to get that guy, or no, not that guy. I mean, if you don't want to, you know, reveal anything, but just, you know, what you thought during your time, you know, as a, you know, somebody who helped make decisions in the NFL, you're like, that's the best thing I did.
There's plenty of things on both sides. I don't want to throw anybody, including myself, under the bus here. So I may withhold answering that one. I need to think about it more. What would be, we did, one thing I was proud of, and this is sort of a nerdy, very under the radar thing. But when I was in Jacksonville a couple times, we did trades where there was a veteran earning a decent amount of money, and we had a pretty favorable cap situation at the time. The team wasn't all that good. There weren't a lot of high-priced veterans, and there were players we wanted to trade, and we received an offer, you know, say we received an offer for a fifth round pick, we would then say, okay, let's make that a third round pick, but we're going to pay off 75% of his salary as a signing bonus before we trade him to you. And so we've essentially paid to buy a better pick. The Browns did something kind of similar with Brock Osweiler. They paid a lot and turned out they couldn't flip Osweiler again. But I think those types of moves are, you know, a pretty interesting way for a team that's maybe more in the rebuilding phase to generate some value and basically put, you know, your cap space as one of your most important assets and put that to work. So again, like nerdy, but the Jags during my time, we did that once. And then right after I left, the team did it again, but I thought those are good moves. And again, like small things around the edges that if you can convert some cap space rather than spending it on a, expensive veteran who's probably not going to take your team over the top anyway. I thought those were wise moves.
All right. I don't know how that'll translate to Dynasty, maybe just some collusion. You know, I'll give you $10 for this.
The Dynasty move, those are really mostly moves for the future, which I think Dynasty players understand very well. Like there's a lot of the pressures that happen in regular sports, with real teams, it's not so easy to just tear it down and say, we're done for the year. Whereas in Dynasty, there's no fans who are going to call for your head as the GM. So right. It's a little easier to pack it in.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Is there anything that you would like to say, promote? You want to promote the Twins web store or something?
Hopefully people, I know this is a fantasy football focused podcast, but hopefully people, watch some baseball and root for the Twins, and hopefully sports can happen safely. That would be my greatest hope. I guess wear a mask. Don't be an idiot. I won't get too political beyond that, but.
No, I mean, you can. I mean, this is a wear a mask podcast. Don't be an idiot podcast as well.
Excellent.
I don't care if we betray any of our 30 listeners.
Yeah. Who knows? Odds are somebody in that 30 is anti-mask.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you for your time.
Thanks.